Heroin has become an increasingly dangerous problem across the country, also here in Iowa. This hour, perspectives from a recent state heroin summit. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll hear from a Davenport mother who lost her son to heroin, also award-winning journalist Sam Quinones, as well as the perspectives from addiction treatment and law enforcement.
We need to be thinking more about treatment than imprisonment. We need to be thinking more about what we're going to do with these people when they get out of prison than we are about mandatory minimums.
Heroin and opioids, a community crisis. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A special edition of our program today coming to you, recorded at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. And there's a summit going on at the University of Iowa College of Public Health titled Heroin and Opioids, a Community Crisis. It's a day-long University of Iowa summit focusing on issues related to heroin and prescription opioid abuse. A lot of perspectives here that we hope you'll hear this hour. Law enforcement perspectives, education, also healthcare professionals. We'll hear from all of them. The reason we're doing this and the reason for the summit is that heroin has become an increasingly dangerous problem across the country and also here in Iowa. And first of all, I'm talking with Kim Brown of Davenport. Kim is part of this summit to share a parent's perspective here. Kim's son died of a heroin overdose in 2011. Andy Lamp is Kim's son. He was 33 years old when he died of the heroin overdose. Kim Brown, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Very painful story you have to tell here at the summit, I'm sure. Tell us a little bit about your son's heroin use. When did it first come to your attention?
I think the heroin use came to my attention right around 2001. We noticed that he was having some problems for some time, and actually his older brother told me that he saw needle marks on his arm.
Did you ever talk to him at some point about this? Did you have the sort of relationship where you could raise this with him?
Yes, we talked quite often because prior to that he had had drug use issues, and he had had a surgery when he was 14, which I believe may have precipitated his heroin use. He had a bowel obstruction and had to have abdominal surgery.
So that's interesting. The surgery, you think, has something to do with his abuse and eventual addiction. We're also talking about prescription drugs here, opioids that are used as commonly as painkillers. Is that sort of the gateway that you're describing here?
I've been asked that before, and I'm going to be very honest with you and say that it could have very well played into it, but I'll never know for sure. I can only tell you that he did have surgery when he was 14, and after his surgery, it seemed like his drug use escalated.
And what did you do as his mother? What could you do? Because by this time, he's growing older through his teens into his 20s. He died, as I mentioned, when he was in his early 30s. Give us an idea of what you tried to do to help him.
It became... substance use disorder ends up being a family disorder. And so it basically put our whole family into chaos, and we did what we could to protect him. He had been in treatment several times. When he was younger and went back to school after his surgery, he didn't do well. He had associations, friends that used drugs as well. So we tried to micromanage his time. We tried to keep an eye on him, supervise him. He would skip classes in school, and it got to the point where I actually went to school and sat with him. But he managed to see his friends, and a lot of times it was when I was at work.
Can you recall an instance that you were sort of at the height of your worry about him?
I would say the height of my worry began as far back as I can trace it to 2001. He'd straightened out. He was working. He was going to school for computer aided drafting. He was doing okay. And then all of a sudden he just declined.
This is in his early mid-20s, is the time you're describing?
Close, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what happened when he declined? What did you see happen to him?
He had a small family at that time. In 2001, his first son was born, and then 15 months later, his second son was born. And it just put the whole family in chaos. He got in some trouble, went to jail for a short time, court-ordered treatment, got out, and I was very hopeful. But he continued to use.
When you look at the system that you encountered to help your son, what was there to support you when you saw your son getting increasingly in trouble with drugs and eventually to heroin? What was there to help you? What did you find most effective?
I didn't find very much support in 2001 and in those years, and even earlier. You know, most of your friends, the few that you could talk to, were just grateful it wasn't their child. And most of the professionals at that time were really promoting the tough love theory. I couldn't do that. I loved my son. I wanted to protect him.
The tough love theory mean it's more punishing.
Yes, punishing, let him hit the bottom. Kick them out of the house, don't give them anything, and once they hit bottom, then they'll want help.
What is your message for this summit to the people who work in healthcare, in law enforcement, in treatment? How can we do better here? We obviously have to do much better.
I think we need to identify substance use disorder as a brain disease and not a moral failing. I think we have to reach out and do a better job with our treatment settings. We need to expand the use of naloxone in Iowa, which we have not been able to do yet.
Naloxone, tell us about that drug, because a lot of our listeners will not know what that is and its connection to heroin.
Well, naloxone is an antidote to an opiate overdose. It's not only heroin. It could be any of the opiates, such as prescription pain medications we've spoken about. And basically, when somebody overdoses, they stop breathing. It affects their respiratory system. And what naloxone does is when you either it can be injected, IM, it can be used as a nasal spray, and it will reverse, it locks onto the opiate receptors where it kicks the heroin or the opiate out, locks onto those receptors, and restores breathing in 1 to 3 minutes.
And Iowa is in a minority of states that don't allow families to access this drug, which also goes under the brand name of Narcan.
Yes.
Would you like to see that changed?
I certainly would.
Do you think that could have made a difference in your son's case?
Well, the third time he overdosed, he wasn't alone. I'll never know that, but what I can tell you is the pain that my family's been through, the pain his children have been through, and what I live with every day. I would love to see the access to naloxone expanded so another family doesn't have to go through this grief.
Kim Brown, thank you very much. My condolences to you and your family for the loss of your son. Andy died when he was 33 years old of a heroin overdose in Davenport in the year 2011. Thank you, Kim Brown.
Thank you.
You're listening to a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're recording a series of conversations at the University of Iowa College of Public Health today because they're having a summit titled Heroin and Opioids, a Community Crisis. We're talking with a number of people to get perspectives on this increasingly dangerous problem across the country, also here in Iowa, from law enforcement, from an education perspective, also healthcare professionals. Right now, sitting with me is award-winning journalist Sam Quinones. He is a keynote speaker for this summit. He's the author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate epidemic. He's investigated many aspects of what's changed here in the last few decades, the system of distribution in this country, a new way of distributing heroin. Sam, nice you could join us.
Glad to be here.
You've spent years researching this problem, the heroin crisis. Perhaps because we're here in Iowa, you're in Iowa, set this crisis that Iowa is experiencing to some degree in the larger context of the problem encompassing the country and this hemisphere.
I think what's happened is really that, yes, Iowa is part of a much larger national story that begins with a revolution, a change, fundamental change in our approach to pain treatment and our belief in what prescription painkillers can do and how much risk they involve when you are prescribed them. This changed in the beginning in the 1980s, really in the 1990s, to say that we are, first of all, a country in pain. We need to treat this pain very aggressively. And by the way, these pills that we always thought were addictive, now we know that they're not, or they're not when used to treat pain. A lot of that was incorrect. Certainly the idea that these pills can be used without any risk of addiction is crazy talk. And a lot of people all across the country have exactly become addicted to these pills. Some have used them recreationally due to the fact that those pills have been prescribed massively all across the country. But number two, a lot of people have also been addicted to these pills that they've been prescribed by doctors and have used them just as doctors have said they should, and they still get addicted. These pills are molecularly very, very similar to heroin. They have the same euphoria if you abuse them. They have the same withdrawals if you're trying to kick them. And they have the same effect on the brain chemistry.
Okay. Just to make sure we have the attention of people who may be taking these prescription drugs, when we look in the medicine cabinet, yeah, what are the names that you're referring to specifically?
These pills are Percocet, Lortab, Lorset, Vicodin, and, of course, OxyContin. OxyContin is different from the others because the others have in them usually Tylenol, acetaminophen, something that will prevent their abuse. You use a lot of them, they start damaging your liver, your kidneys, and so people don't tend to stop when using. The difference with OxyContin is it only includes the opiate painkiller because it's a time release thing. You want to release it over a 12-hour period in order to get that much pain relief. You need to include a lot of the drug in the pill. So there's 40 milligrams instead of 10 milligrams with, say, Vicodin, some of the lower dose Vicodin, or 80 milligrams also in OxyContin. If you use these, they do work. They're legitimate pain drugs. But they also have an outsized risk of abuse. Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that the marketing of these through pharmaceutical companies, also in our culture, they've been sold to us as very low-risk drugs, and we're seeing that that's just not the case now.
That's precisely right. They were marketed for the first 6 years of OxyContin's life. It was marketed as if it were virtually non-addictive was the buzzword. Less than 1% of all pain patients get addicted to these drugs. That's how it was marketed. And that's how they calm the nerves, basically, of an entire medical generation.
And was there any data to back up the claim that they were non-addictive?
There was none. There still is none. In fact, it's a very dicey kind of almost art rather than science, figuring out who might be at risk and who might not be at risk. You don't really know ahead of time. When you prescribe a drug to someone, you don't really know how much at risk that person is. You can make educated guesses, but that requires a lot of time talking with the patient, finding out, is there addiction in your background? Have you had any? Have your grandparents been addicted to anything? Have you smoked marijuana? All these kinds of things that are part of the questionnaire. People don't really get asked them. For years now, we have prescribed these pills as if they were non-addictive, just prescribing them aggressively for almost sometimes very minor things, like the extraction of wisdom teeth, for example.
Okay, so connect this now with the problem of heroin abuse that we're seeing, Sam Quinones, because you've researched and written about how the heroin, this black tar heroin, gets to the United States and how it's distributed. And it's really fascinating because we tend to think, old school perhaps, that it's an urban problem. And when we think of Hollywood, we might think of Serpico or the French Connection, but it's not that anymore.
No, it's certainly not. That's the revolution that we've seen. One thing is that most of our heroin now comes from Mexico or Colombia, no longer the Far East. That means that it's cheaper than ever. And heroin, as well as being kind of very molecularly the same as a lot of these pills, the drugs in a lot of these pills, is also much, much cheaper. And so as you grow addicted and your tolerance increases and you need more and more of these pills to either get high or to stay well, after a while, economically, it just doesn't make any sense to continue using the pills when you have heroin that you could use for about a fifth the price and have the same effect. And so people begin that transition. Sometimes, frequently, I think they're helped along because at the end of their addiction with pills, they're shooting up OxyContin. They're no longer popping the pill or snorting it or smoking. They're shooting up. And so once you use the needle, you're kind of beyond that problem of, I don't want to use the needle. Fear of the needle is you're over that, and so people begin to switch to heroin, and the traffickers have figured this out. The group that I write about in my book figured it out first many years ago in the 1990s. They figured this out, and they were the first to systematically exploit the pill market for what it was going to eventually be, which was a heroin market. More recently, the larger cartels in Mexico have figured this out. Sinaloa cartel primarily now funnels enormous amounts of heroin to Chicago. A lot of that ends up out here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And the distribution of it in our communities in Iowa, because we have the counties in Iowa that are most affected, according to the data we have, Linn County, Johnson County, Scott County. These are all counties most connected with the tentacles, if I can say it that way, coming from Chicago. And you make the point that heroin is being distributed much like we buy pizza. Describe that.
In some areas, not in Iowa, that is the method. And I describe in the book a town that really innovated that method of selling, like delivering pizza. You, as an addict, would call a number. A dispatcher is waiting for your call, takes your call, calls in turn a driver, one of three or four drivers he has tooling around whatever city he has, he's working, and dispatches that driver with the heroin to near your house, a few blocks away normally, or some large parking lot or store or something like that where you meet, and then you drive off somewhere and they make the deal. That business model is in many, many towns across America. A lot of towns on the West Coast, the western side of the United States, Portland, Las Vegas, Denver, L.A., et cetera, but also now east of the Mississippi River in Columbus, Charlotte, Indianapolis, Memphis, Cincinnati, places like that, all now have those. This group from this one town, Jalisco Nayarit, is really one of the great centers of heroin supply to the United States. But they are not by any means the only ones. And now what's happened is the cartels, the much larger, very violent, very, very aggressive groups down in Mexico, have figured out the pill market too. And they are beginning to just funnel more and more heroin into their markets. Largely are the big cities, Chicago, New York City, L.A., that kind of thing.
If you just joined us, award-winning journalist Sam Quiñones is my guest at this time. We're getting various perspectives on the heroin epidemic, the heroin crisis across the country and also here in Iowa. He's a keynote speaker at the Heroin and Opioids Summit at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. He is the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. I can imagine, Sam, people listening to this and saying, I don't see that happening in my community here in Iowa. I can understand, okay, there are people who have real problems. You find them under underpasses, living. But these are people, everyday people, they could be your neighbors, that somehow sink, maybe it's through prescription drugs, they sink into this path. And so it could really happen to most anybody, our neighbors?
It's always through prescription drugs. Prescription painkillers are the gateway to this whole problem. And the problem is that those painkillers have been prescribed very aggressively and nationally all across the country for all manner of ailments, for all manner of surgeries. And even people who don't get addicted to them. A lot of people don't get addicted to them. They can use them and they're fine. You don't know which people those are ahead of time, but a lot of people don't get addicted to them. But still, it's that rising supply that is the problem. All across the country, people have been prescribed this, and a lot of that supply ends up in the black market. And that's, you know, people get prescribed 60 Vicodin for some surgery. They take two or three, 57 Vicodin stay in their medicine cabinet for years. Well, workers come by, friends of their children, whatever it happens to be, those pills are very much at risk. And that's what has happened. Those pills have leaked out into the black market for addicts to use and people to get addicted with, oftentimes recreationally. But it's that excess supply. A lot of times we talk about what is the root of these problems, demand or supply. In this case, supply created this problem. There was no demand. There was no demand in a lot of these suburbs for heroin before the pills became widely and aggressively prescribed nationwide.
Where do you see this going in the future, in the next few years?
A few things are happening that I think are very interesting. One is that more and more parents are beginning to talk about it. So the people that you hadn't heard about are now you're hearing about. And this thing spread because people were very quiet. They were mortified. Their children were addicted, or their spouse was addicted, and this was so far away from their normal life experience that they were horrified by it, terrified by it. They didn't talk about it. For years, no one talked about this, made up euphemisms. They didn't put it in the obituary when their 27-year-old son suddenly died, anything like that. Now all of that is beginning to change the last 6 months. It's become more possible to talk about it. Candidates, particularly on the Republican side, are now talking about treatment, which is a radical change for the right in this country. It seems to me very you could not get elected in many areas if you talk like that 10 years ago, if you're from a Republican, you know, side of the line.
Drug culture has been changing here in the United States. We have at least a couple of states that now allow recreational use of marijuana. Listeners may be asking, is there a tie in here? Can marijuana be a gateway drug to heroin?
The gateway drugs to heroin are prescription pills, but marijuana frequently is used by kids who then go to the prescription pills recreationally. I believe that there most likely is some connection between kids who smoke pot and then move on to recreationally use these pills. Frequently I've been told that, certainly. A lot of people tell me that. But the thing that really gets people hooked, that the opiates are enormously addictive and very difficult to kick. And so once you get, I don't believe you can use those recreationally at all. Really, I don't think so. You begin to use those, it's a very slippery slope. You're very quickly into addiction. Most people are anyway. And so the gateway drug, is, in my opinion, the pills. Pot may, again, have something to do, particularly hyperpotent pot that we've got around today, may have something to do with how kids get ready to take the pills if they're using them recreationally.
Okay. Thank you very much, award-winning journalist Sam Quinones, author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He's the keynote speaker at the University of Iowa College of Public Health's Summit, Heroin and Opioids, a Community Crisis. Thank you so much, Sam.
Certainly my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
When we come back after a short break, we'll continue with this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Heroin and Opioids, Community Crisis. That's the summit at which we are recording all of these conversations, conversations with professionals in education, healthcare, and law enforcement about the heroin crisis, the heroin epidemic in the United States and also in Iowa, and its ties to prescription drugs. When we come back, we'll get the perspective from law enforcement, also healthcare. We'll talk about how to better treat heroin addiction. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, covering what is a heroin summit taking place at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. This has been recorded on the day that the university has had over 200 different professionals come to share their perspectives, from law enforcement, education, healthcare professionals, also very personal ones. So we heard in the first half hour a parent of a young man who died from a heroin addiction from Davenport. This half hour, we want to talk about the perspective from law enforcement and also from healthcare.
My name is Pat Reinert. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I'm the drug chief in the Northern District of Iowa. I've been with the U.S. Attorney's Office since 1990, so I've seen lots of different drug trends over the years, but heroin is really hitting us hard in the law enforcement community, but also in a public safety setting.
Give us some historical perspective. How, you said it hit us hard. When were you first aware of it, and in what form?
I actually prosecuted the first heroin case in the Northern District of Iowa that they could remember in the mid-90s, and it was a small seizure of about 6 grams of black tar heroin. Everyone said there was a heroin in the district, but nobody could ever find it. Now we're seeing heroin everywhere. In mid-2005, we started seeing overdose deaths in pockets of the community, and that increased exponentially between 2011 and 2012. We prosecuted probably 35 or 40 heroin dealers out of Waterloo and Blackhawk County and Linn counties, and the problem has gotten much worse in the last few years.
When I look at some of the statistics here, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're looking at the counties that show the most data in terms of this in eastern Iowa, Scott County, Johnson and Linn counties. These so there's a connection, the geography connection to Chicago. Tell us how this network of distribution works.
What we have seen historically is a lot of the eastern Iowa drug problems have always been connected to Chicago, usually through the Mexican cartels bringing larger quantities of drugs to Chicago, being sold to the gang organizations like the Gangster Disciples or Black Disciples. And then as it goes down through that gang system, it then comes over into other areas like eastern Iowa and Cedar Rapids. And as we, with heroin, we've seen the same pattern as we did with the crack cocaine back in the 90s.
Describe specifically how it might be distributed here in Iowa. We talked with Sam Quinones, the journalist who talked about how this is really a revolution, that heroin is being distributed in some communities like pizza.
Sam's book focused more on black tar heroin distribution networks. We have not seen the black tar heroin here at all. The heroin we're getting here is generally a more refined, more processed heroin. It's usually a tan type of heroin. Still heroin distributed by the cartel, still driven through the heartland, through Chicago. But ultimately, you're going to have the same type of delivering networks. You're going to have small nodes of distributors that will sell heroin to known customers. So it's very difficult to get into those heroin networks. You have to have known points of contact. And you will have some of that same pizza model delivery system where you'll have a centralized number where you call, you know, a particular number and you don't know who's going to show up. It's going to be one of, you know, 5 to 12 people.
And that really poses a challenge for law enforcement, doesn't it, to track this very agile type of distribution network.
Absolutely. The heroin networks are much more agile and much more like a starfish, that they can regenerate very quickly because they're so nebulous in form. So law enforcement, we have to stay one step ahead using any means we can to identify who's involved with who and try and keep that ability of the network to get heroin on the streets, tamp that down as much as we can until we can have the longer-term efforts really bear fruit, which is the prevention and the treatment efforts.
Okay, thank you very much, Pat Reinert, Assistant U.S. Attorney with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're at the University of Iowa College of Public Health's Summit. This is a recorded program. The title of the summit, Heroin and Opioids, a Community Crisis. Many different perspectives this hour. We're gathering at the summit. There are over 200 different people attending this summit, law enforcement, education, healthcare professionals. We're getting a sense of the increasing danger that heroin is posing to Iowa as it is to the rest of the nation.
Hello, my name is Officer Al Fear with the Cedar Rapids Police Department. I'm currently assigned to the task force with the United States Attorney's Office on the Heroin Initiative.
So, Officer Fear, tell us, what is the Heroin Initiative? You're based in Cedar Rapids. We know that Linn County is one of the Iowa counties most affected by this heroin crisis.
That's correct. We're responsible right now for Johnson County, Linn County, Blackhawk County, and Dubuque. I'm responsible for community outreach to give presentations for community associations regarding the heroin epidemic that we're currently having and what people can do to help alleviate this situation. I'm responsible for law enforcement education. I'm responsible for various activities in the community, such as prescription pill drop boxes. Mm-hmm. I'm currently working on prescription pill boxes for all the law enforcement agencies in Johnson County.
What does law enforcement have to learn to add to their awareness and in the way they treat maybe a drug scene so that we can more effectively combat this crisis?
Well, so far up to date, these overdose scenes have been just simple medical calls. You come in, the person is unconscious from using the heroin. It's a scoop and go type of situation where it's just a medical call. What we're liking law enforcement to do now is to treat it as a crime scene so we can collect all the evidence and the data and hopefully get to the source of the heroin, the user.
You've been to how many, would you say, drug scenes that are now treated as crime scenes?
In my career, I've been to a countless number of overdose cases. Before I was in this position, I was sent to an overdose, a heroin overdose. And when I got on scene, the gentleman was unconscious on the floor, and his girlfriend had witnessed the overdose. And I did rescue breathing for the subject, and the paramedics got there, gave him the Narcan. He came back, ended up standing up, started talking to me. My first mindset for being in law enforcement was I saw another syringe of heroin in the kitchen, and my plan is to take this guy to jail because he's obviously a heroin user. Now, with being in the Heroin Initiative and understanding the problem of heroin here in the Midwest, my mindset is one of treatment and recovery rather than incarceration of these people that are addicted to heroin. And we're trying to spread the word to law enforcement agencies throughout Iowa that we're, instead of constantly putting these people in the system, we want to get them into recovery.
And I understand, Officer Fear, you have a very personal connection with this crisis. Would you mind telling us about that a little?
Absolutely. I have a family member who grew up abusing Ritalin and getting addicted to prescription medication. Ended up abusing that and moving on to heroin. And it was a very difficult, probably 10, 15 years of his life. He was one of the largest heroin dealers in the Cedar Rapids metro area. And it took 8 months in jail for him to realize that this was not the path that he wanted to go down and for the heroin to get out of his system. And luckily, as of today, he's been clean for over 2 years. And he's been outstanding now that he's been through recovery. So that's what I want to do for everybody.
All right. Thank you for your perspective, Officer Al Fear with the Heroin Initiative based at the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Thank you, Officer Fear.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My name is Nick Kleinfeld. I'm the United States Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa. And we're here today because we recognize that we're not going to be able to prosecute our way out of our heroin problem. We need to be thinking more about what we're going to do with these people when they get out of prison than we are about mandatory minimums. We need to bring all the communities together, not just the law enforcement community, but the medical community, the dental community, the pharmacy community, and the treatment community.
So tell us, in your district, the Southern District of Iowa, what trends have you been observing that set off the alarm bells?
Well, I've been United States Attorney for 6 years. Tomorrow's my last day as United States Attorney. And one of the things I've noticed, you know, personally and dramatically is that 6 years ago when I came into the office, we didn't see heroin cases. Just didn't see it. Now we have heroin cases. We have heroin overdose deaths. It's here. And I think the problem's going to get worse before it gets better.
Is everybody on board with that shift in attitude and approach to tackling this problem, you think?
Well, we've had a lot of people that have been doing it one way for a long time. And change can be hard. And but I think there is an overwhelming feeling out there that we need to be taking a different approach. And I think, you know, pulling back from the mandatory minimums, using a little bit more discretion, a little bit more focus, is that a new approach? And I think there's a lot of support behind it.
What can you tell to listeners? Certainly some listeners will have been personally affected in their families by this heroin crisis. Others will not even be very much aware of it, even though it may be present in their communities. What can you tell us about action that people can take to impact this crisis in a positive way?
The first thing is to be aware of what's in your medicine cabinet. A lot of people get prescribed prescription painkillers for very legitimate reasons. There's a lot of people taking them for very legitimate reasons. But they tend to stick around in people's medicine cabinets. And if you're not going to use them, you know, there may be a kid out there who's going to access your medicine cabinet and use them in the wrong way. So be cognizant of that. Do you need them? In the first place, how long do you need them? What are you going to do with them when you're done? There's a lot of great take-back programs out there. And then second, really sort of be aware of your surroundings. You know, see something, say something in terms if you're seeing a loved one who you think is battling addiction, because that's a real personal and substantial issue to a lot of us.
What does this heroin summit represent to you in battling the heroin epidemic, bringing together so many different perspectives, different professionals? Is it a turning point, you think?
I think it's a turning point in a couple of ways. I hope it's a turning point in our battle with heroin. And I also hope it's a turning point in our battle with drug abuse in general, a recognition that we need to take a more holistic approach to our drug problem.
Okay, thank you very much. Nick Kleinfeld is the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
My name is Joe Cowley, and I'm with the Center for Alcohol and Drug Services in the Quad Cities. The message that I like to bring to anybody when it comes to addiction is I think that it crosses all barriers. I think that there's addiction crosses all forms of life and socioeconomic. My example of that would be my own life. When I moved to Iowa, this is the 28th state that I've lived in. And my father was vice president of AT&T. And so we moved a lot. And I remember my mom saying, I used to think my dad had a drinking problem because he really acted kind of very bizarre when you've been drinking for a while. And my mother kept saying, he doesn't have a drinking problem. He doesn't have an OWI. Never had a DUI. Never this. And then when I was like in my 40s and I was working in this field as being a teacher, I remember all of a sudden I started thinking about this guy named Ken. Ken was my dad's driver. See, at that particular time, AT&T was having so many problems with their upper management getting DUIs or getting drunk driving or having, you know, after lunch, those kind of, you know, liquid lunches, that kind of thing. And good people, don't get me wrong. But they were having so many problems that they hired them drivers. And I remember saying to my mom, Dad doesn't have a drinking problem because you don't think he has an OWI or DUI. It's because he doesn't drive. Ken drives. So it was a separate – she could make that in her mind. She could go, this works because he never got this. Well, no, it doesn't work because he would have it and he'd been driving. So my message is I think addiction is part of the human condition. I think that everybody battles something. We all have something. We get up that morning and try to do something about it, and sometimes we relapse back. And if we really take it from that perspective, we understand the folks that are dealing with this a lot better, I think.
Joe, as an expert here, our expert on addiction and treatment for addiction, tell us specifically about heroin addiction, the nature of this addiction, and what makes it unique from other addictions.
I think heroin addiction is different because so many people are using it now. I think that people get addicted faster to this particular drug. And we're seeing that there's a lot of young people. That's my biggest concern. We have a lot of young people that are trying this drug because they started out with a sports injury, so they got the OxyContin or they got the drug medication because they went in for, you know, an accident or whatever, and, you know, on the playing field or whatever, and then they had to have surgery. And then it led from that to they couldn't get the OxyContin or the pain medication, so they go to the heroin. Mm-hmm.
So we should get out of our minds these cliches that we have of heroin abusers and heroin addicts. These are people we don't expect. Who?
They're us. They're us. They're all of us. They're people. And some can be people that are down or out. Some can be the disenfranchised in our community. That's still there. But some of them are your neighbors. They're like us.
Give us an idea of the types of treatment available. What is the treatment process? Is there an agreed upon best treatment?
Best practices. There is. We do. There are some of it short term. So we do short term interventions. We do cognitive behavioral therapy. We do rational emotive therapy. So some of that RET or some of the CBT. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get people to say, okay, when you start using, what happens is they get the urge to use, they go and they use. What we're trying to do with CBT, which is the cognitive behavioral therapy or the rational motor therapy, we're trying to say to them is before you do from here, you jump to here. What about these steps? So have you stopped to think about what are the consequences? Have you stopped to think about what may be the consequences of that particular behavior with the law or with your job, with your wife, with your EAP, whoever? And we do a lot with the criminal thinking process as well, because we have a lot. I mean, I have one guy that in group, and he was yelling at me, if she would have just let go of her purse, and the key word that I had to keep pointing out to him, her purse. Get it? Not your purse, and it was her purse. But he said, I wouldn't have broke her arm had she just let go of her purse. Think about that. And drugs make people do things, or the addiction makes people do things they wouldn't normally do. Steal from family, whatever. So heirlooms go, whatever. However they can get their money to get those drugs, they're going to do it.
Are there enough resources in Iowa, in your area, in eastern Iowa, which is very, very much affected by the heroin epidemic here? Are there enough resources now to treat people?
No. I think there needs to be more resources allocated towards treatment. And I think treatment's viewed as being soft instead of helping people. And that, to me, is a concern.
So in terms of resources, we need more staff, more people educated, trained to deal with these kind of addictions?
All levels. We need physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, counselors, techs, program aides. We need all levels. I mean, the workforce is becoming a big issue for everyone, and it's hitting us just as hard.
And, of course, that requires money to get more resources. Do you see the political will out there to devote those resources, to devote the money to those resources?
It's been interesting listening to the current debates that are going on for the presidential debate, where they're talking more about more humane ways to address addiction issues. And I'm not saying whether I'm Republican, Democrat, or independent, whatever, but I'm glad to hear that conversation going on, because I think that is what needs to happen so that people recognize that we can either try to build our way out of it through prisons and all that kind of stuff, and putting people behind bars, or we can actually help them. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that this crosses party lines now, this change in mindset and approach?
Yes. Yes.
Are you involved in cases of overdose?
Yes.
Okay. How often does that happen?
In our program, we actually have had it where we had one gentleman probably around, I want to say maybe 9 years ago, that actually passed away. He went out on his furlough and used and came back and went to sleep and died. From an overdose. And then we had one woman that passed out. She came, went, same thing. She was in the, we were in the halfway house. So that's a level of care where they're working in the community and they're coming back. And she had used, somebody had offered her heroin. She used it and then passed out in the shower. And had we not been able to stop that, she would have died. Mm-hmm.
So help us understand, you can be a heroin user, an abuser there, and then you overdose. What typically leads to an overdose? Can you for years use heroin? And then what causes the overdose?
The amount that's what people are using, and it also can be caused by what it's being cut with. That's why when you're talking about some of these medications, and they were talking about the 72 tests in Chicago in Cook County a couple weeks, maybe it was about a month ago, and then we had 85 maybe 2 weeks ago, the same county, those were all caused by the heroin was being cut by fentanyl, and it was not pure fentanyl. It wasn't like, you know, pharmaceutical fentanyl. It was used by, they were cutting it just to make more, spread the drugs out and use more. And people, the minute they take that, they die.
Looking forward to the future, what do you see as the biggest obstacles to improving the crisis?
Wow. I think getting treatment for folks is very, very important. And I think treatment can happen in many modalities. It can happen in the prison system. It can happen in the jail system. We do. We actually run a jail treatment program in Scott County Jail for Scott County Sheriff Conard. We run the program in his jail. And I think that's the piece that I'm talking about. If we don't take care of that, and then they're just going to come back either better criminals and not habilitated or rehabilitated. They're going to be released at some point. So how do you want to come back to your community? That's really the question the community has to answer.
Okay, thank you very much. Joe Cowley of the Center for Alcohol and Drug Services in the Quad Cities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And that finishes up this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News at the University of Iowa College of Public Health's Heroin Summit. Heroin and Opioids, a Community Crisis. We've been hearing various perspectives this hour. If you'd like to download this entire program, perhaps share it with someone else, simply go to our website, iowapublicradio.org. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments, your questions. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.